Well, this is Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Karen, and we're building up to the biggest touch tournament for the mental health and addictions sector, October the 30th, Wednesday. It's going to be the first touch tournament in the name of EMBA Wellbeing Services, or EMBA Services. So this touch tournament is the 30th of October. The venue is Cox's Bay Reserve, West End Road. Register by Monday or Tuesday. I know Monday, October the 28th, is part of Labor Weekend. But get those registrations in. Get in touch with me on 021-976-564 if you'd like me to send a registration form. So that's the EMBA Touch Tournament for Mental Health and Addictions. And you've been listening just a little bit to Joe Cocker, a track called Respect Yourself. And Take It From Us is brought to you and funded by EMBA Wellbeing Trust. So Martin, our guest today, has probably packed more trauma and excitement into his life than most of us would in two lifetimes. Martin, whose name is his surname is deliberately withheld, is a consumer advisor in mental health and addiction. He's had his fair share of both, and here he is to tell his larger-than-life story. Martin, welcome to Take It From Us. Today you've been revealing that you have some exposure to Access Radio way down south.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here today, Sheldon. Yeah, I've had a bit of experience with Otago Access Radio down in Otipote, where I was living previously. I co-hosted a show called AA Live, and we went to air twice a month where people share their experience, strength and hope in their recovery from alcoholism.
And a successful show?
Well, it's hard sometimes to gauge how successful you're being. I think at the end of the day, if we could touch one life, we'd consider that a success, wouldn't we?
Yeah, well, I think sometimes we touch the life of our guest who goes away having fun and enjoying the experience, even though they may come into the studio a bit nervous.
Yeah, well, I think fun's sort of what it's all about at the end of the day, because recovery for me probably... more discovery, discovering how to lead a rich and full life. And, you know, I always go back to the old one, misery's optional.
Right. So misery's not part of the agenda anymore?
It can creep in occasionally, but I give myself a jolly good talking to and send it packing normally. But, you know, that's on a good day. And let's face it, each and every one of us has our challenges in life. And it's sometimes it's just about getting up and knowing that somebody else is there and that somebody else understands sort of what it's like to have one of those days.
Yeah, well, so out of a 7-day week, how many days would you rate as being fun and worth being around?
I'd probably go to a monthly cycle, and I'd say out of 30 days, I would have 3 days that I wouldn't actually call particularly crash hot. They might be days when I just can't be bothered doing anything. I might have physically overdone things, or I might have allowed a few stresses or a bit of dishonesty to creep into my life and everything. So 27 out of the 30 are normally pretty good. Of those 27, I'd say 15 to 18 are probably extraordinary.
Right. So what are you doing about those other three that aren't quite so crash hot? Got a policy for that?
Yeah, well, I think for me, probably the first thing is to recognise that those days are coming. Sometimes it's actually about realising that perhaps something I've done previously is actually leading towards that. I suppose in a sort of a mental wellness framework, we'd call them sort of spotting the early warning signs. I have a little bit of a ritual where my bed is in the middle of the room, and when I first get up in the morning, I put my feet on the floor and everything, and I just have a bit of a stock take about where I'm at with the world and everything. And if I'm not too crash hot, I get back into bed and get out the other side and sort of try and change my attitude. It might sound a bit silly to some people, but some days it works.
Well, I fear that some people in mental health may have their bed in the middle of the room, but they get out, they do a bit of a stock take, and then they get back into bed and they stay in bed.
Well, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that occasionally I did pull the covers back up and say goodbye to the world for the day.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay. But that's only that's maybe one out of those 3 days, but the other 27 are pretty good.
Yeah, they are pretty good. I've had a lot of help developing those strategies that make those days good. And, you know, being part of the show is actually sort of part of the whole recipe for it and everything. I found it very important to connect with people at a meaningful level. I've found my experience of addiction and mental distress to be places of isolation. And so I've tried to build up slowly trusting, worthwhile relationships. And I suppose in the process, I've found that some relationships from my past aren't very conclusive to a happy and contented life because they're built on falsehoods.
Well, you certainly connected at Drive Direction, which is part of Ember, where you spoke a couple of weeks ago, and where I approached you to do a radio show, to do this radio show. If we just go back a while, what was life like growing up with your family?
Well, I suppose the politically correct description would be dysfunctional, to say the least.
Right. We don't want you to be politically correct on this show.
Okay. I'll go a little bit deeper and a bit more honest with you all. I was the only child of an alcoholic mum and an older father who'd come back from the war with what I considered to be post-traumatic stress disorder. He'd seen things in the war and the Middle East and everything that I don't think anybody would want to see. And he was also a prisoner of war in Germany. So there was a lot of love in our family, but the alcoholism of my mum and the emotional detachment of my dad sort of really distorted that. So I think very early on I learnt some sort of coping behaviours that weren't they actually kept me alive in the sense that I saw the world as being really threatening and a dangerous place and everything. So I learned heightened anxiety and hypervigilance right from the beginning, and I adopted a very negative attitude, which I would consider probably was the beginning of long-standing depression.
A lot of those veterans, though, they came back from the war and they didn't say a lot, did they? I mean, I knew of somebody who lost both his brothers in the war and he never spoke about it.
No.
You know, he was a staunch sort of farmer from down the line, and he never talked about that. How did you get to know about your father's war history?
Well, I only really discovered really about my father after he passed away, and I met a group of men that had been in his battalion and who'd been prisoners of war with him. I knew glimpses of his past and everything. He was a New Zealand famous yachtsman, and he was a crack shot with a rifle and stuff like that, but he never talked about the war. I remember one time I had been drinking quite heavily with my mum, and so I made cheese on toast, and I took cheese on toast to him and everything, and I gave it to him, and he just threw it on the ground. He had like almost a flashback, and what he explained to me afterwards was in the prisoner of war camp, cheese and bread were the only things that they ate, and he had what he called an allergic reaction to cheese.
Yeah, I bet he did. Yeah, it's incredible when that sort of thing. I had an experience where I was outside in a flash hotel, and the woman I was with brought a game along where you put the round coloured things into these slots, You're familiar with it?
Yes, I am familiar with that game.
Yeah. Well, I had been introduced to that game in hospital, in a psychiatric hospital, and I said, please take that away. She never asked me why I was so strident about it, but it was a bit like that cheese on the toasted sandwich.
Yeah, well, I suppose that was the original basis of trauma-informed care, wasn't it? That so many of us, when we sought help, were being re-traumatized by events and things that happened to us and everything. So, trauma seems to be one of those things that many of us have sort of underlying our difficulties.
Mm. So in this early childhood, the family environment, I mean, did you feel abandoned?
Yeah, I think abandonment was a prominent feature of my early life. It was almost as though the people that I expected to look after me and care for me in particular ways actually didn't do it like that. So much of my adult life has really been about forgiveness, not only for them but also for myself, because I developed a way of coping that basically kept me alive. But since I've addressed my addiction and everything, those behaviours are sort of no longer appropriate. I became incredibly self-reliant, to the point of, I would say, bordering on narcissistic, in the sense that my primary drive was to satisfy my own need and everything. I don't try and analyse a lot of that stuff too much and everything. It's a little bit complicated for me. I do share with other people my experiences and encourage them to share their experiences with me. And I encourage each of us just to take out of that experience what's appropriate for us. I think sometimes just getting on with life and putting one foot in front of the other is probably the most important thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, the narcissism, did that come, do you think, from being an only child?
I think it contributed towards it too. Also, I grew up on Aritangi Beach on Waiheke Island, and so me and my dog would be on the beach together. We became very self-sufficient. My dad would leave at 5 o'clock in the morning to catch the Motunui or the Baruna ferry to Auckland,
right?
And I'd see him at 7 o'clock at night. And my mum became a very peripheral figure as she descended into chronic alcoholism.
Well, little aside, I was told that a gang has moved into Aritangi Beach recently, and they're just arbitrating as to where the boundaries are and putting fences up wherever they like, and nobody's challenging them, which is hardly surprising. So,
yeah, well, I suppose it just goes with the rich history of Aritangi and Waiheke, because when I grew up down there, its population was predominantly retired seamen.
Right.
Merchant seamen. And it was a sort of a place of sort of isolation where people could just get on with their lives and everything. And then I think in the mid-70s and the 80s, it became sort of like a marijuana-growing paradise, you know?
Well, they used to have a pub down on Aritangi Beach where Thursday nights all the fishermen and the ex-merchant seamen used to go there. It was hooters and shooters.
Yeah, it was very much like that. A lot of wheeling and dealing and property, real estate and all that sort of thing. It was a thriving centre. My mum would arrive there at the earliest possible time, and I'd be off to the beach.
Right. So, I mean, did you watch that show called The Golf, which was based on Waiheke? And I think the police station was actually, they took over a house on the corner of Aritangi Road and the main road into Aritangi.
Yeah, well, the policeman was a huge sort of part of our family, because my dad used to go fishing with him a lot. And, underneath our house was sort of like, I suppose you'd call it the social club and everything, and we'd have lots of smoked fish and all that sort of stuff. And my dad was a very keen gardener, so we had, you know, vegetables galore and all that sort of stuff and everything. But in those days, the old policeman was a drunkard too.
Right. Well, so there was some positive. There was some positivity there, you know, and your dad was a gardener and a fisherman and...
Yeah, I think in hindsight, that's been one of the gifts of addressing my addiction and my mental distress, is that I've been able to cast a more positive light on my past. I don't find any room anymore for resentment or hatred or stuff like that. I find them to be very negative emotions that somehow, if I harbour those emotions, they tend to gravitate me back towards what I would consider to be unwellness.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say that, because I had a discussion with a woman yesterday, and she said, I feel so much grief and guilt about my mental unwellness in relation to my husband and my two young children, and I feel they, you know, they missed out. And I said, but how is that grief and guilt going to help you now?
Yeah, well, you know, emotions are there for a particular reason. Evolutionary-wise, they've evolved over time and everything, but I do think they have a time and a place. And if I was to think really about things, emotions are emotions and actions are actions, and I don't have to link the emotion to the reaction. I think in the past, if I had a strong emotional response, then it was inevitable that I did a particular action.
Right.
And so consequently, over a period of time, I've been able to build up alternative ways of acting despite those very strong emotions.
Yeah.
I, you know, my heart goes out to the woman that you're talking about, because I can sort of empathise with, I suppose, shame and guilt about the way I've behaved and the way I've been at times and everything like that. But, you know, so long as I'm trying today to do the best I can, I think that's a living amends, if you know what I mean. And, you know, life's difficult for all of us, isn't it, in some way, shape or form.
Well, let's on that note take a music break. And Declan, what are you playing for us today?
Well, I've got a track today from Pink, but I was just going to say, if anyone's listening live to us, so if you listen to the pre-record later on, it won't obviously apply, but if you're listening now live and there's a song that you'd like me to play in the weeks coming up, while the music's playing, you can give us a call on 815 8100, if you know who it is. I won't put you on air, and I won't mention any names, but if you've got something you like, let's go for it. This song in particular, okay, this singer Pink, she got into drugs when she was a lot younger. Her friends were selling cocaine, and she found a male friend who was dead from a drug overdose when she was 14. Most of those at the funeral were just children, she also commented on that. So she's been through some pretty big trauma herself. Here is Pink with Who Knew. You're listening to Take It From Us Mental Health Radio, broadcasting here every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM.
You took my hand, you showed me how, you promised me you'd be around. That's right. Took your words and I believed in everything you said to me. Yeah, that's right. And so convinced and just too cool.
With Who Knew You was taken from us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting every Tuesday right here from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM. I'm just going to say there that when I looked up some information on that track this morning, I had a touch of sadness to it, actually, just seeing what the song was all about and what she'd actually been through, which I didn't know about before, so... very strong.
Well, I'm host Sheldon Brown. We're on here.
I better push your buttons. You had your muted then.
Oh, did you? Well, we're all going now. And we're talking today to Martin, who is a consumer advisor in mental health and addictions with his own fair share of both. When did you sort of first get into the mental health system and how was that experience?
I was incarcerated in M1 or M2 in Oakley in the late 1970s as a result of experiencing psychosis, drug-induced psychosis from LSD. I'd engaged in some antisocial behaviour that brought me to the attention of the police, and because of the presence of psychosis, I couldn't be charged, but I was detained as a... I suppose you'd call it a compulsory client of the mental health system.
Can I just ask, was that in a forensic unit then?
Yes, it was. The sort of term forensic really only sort of came to the forefront after the Mason inquiry. It was there in those days, but it was very different in those days. And very draconian. The conditions under which we were detained were pretty awful, really.
Was there such a thing as seclusion, or?
Seclusion was a very common experience. If you didn't behave or comply, for want of a better reason, it was a very prominent feature, and restraint, very very violent physical restraint, and chemical restraint also.
What about shock treatment?
Shock treatment was a very prominent feature of psychiatry in those days. One of my friends who was in the unit with me actually ended up dying after shock treatment. Mike Watney, his nickname was Charcoal. He died after shock treatment.
A bit ironic after dying from shock treatment, isn't it?
Well, he evidently, the story goes that he wasn't given the muscle relaxant or something as a result of that. And it was just in those days before we were starting to take a sort of, for want of a better word, a recovery perspective on things and everything. Certainly things have changed nowadays. I always like what Phil Patera, a nursing academic, used to say to me. He used to say to me, we've come a long way, it's taken a long time, and we've got a long way to go. And I think that's a rather a positive way of looking at it, because I look at my life like that, and I understand that many people like myself have had very negative experiences of the psychiatric system. But later in life, I was to experience all the good things that were on offer in terms of treatment modalities and caring relationships and stuff like that and everything. So,
well, it was an occasion, I think, when you were taken to a psych ward by two constables or two policemen, and what happened then?
Well, it was quite yes. I was I'd moved to Dunedin, Odipote, to do some postgraduate study, and I was relatively new into an alcohol and drug-free life, and I was experiencing some very real depression and anxiety and everything, and I became dangerous not only to myself but to others, and I was escorted from student health to emergency psych services, and the most amazing thing happened to me. The nurse that was directly opposite me said, how can we help you? And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then so I was taken in and I was assessed. And the comment that she made to me was, gosh, you've done really well to get here. And I thought to myself, well, didn't you see the two blokes under each arm and everything? But I think what it was just the way that she approached things. It was a very non-judgmental, it was a very caring thing. And I was given a number of options that I could pursue from there. One of them was hospitalisation in the ward, and they said to me that they didn't think that was necessary if I could assure them that I wouldn't be a danger to myself or others, which I could at that stage. And then they offered me respite care and the opportunity to participate in a day activities program designed to sort of help me cope a lot more and everything. So I made a bit of a pact with them that I would take my medication and that I would every lunchtime turn up and have lunch and that sort of stuff and everything. So
turn up at that particular facility just to show that you were okay.
Yeah. Well, it was my commitment to them, it became more of a two-way process rather than they're doing it to me. I was actually involved in my own care. Yeah. And I was able to say that certain medications didn't agree with me, and we were able to negotiate alternatives.
That sounds like a wonderfully compassionate treatment, and I'd venture to say that if the mental health system is going to change, and if this inquiry into mental health and addictions is going to have success, it's about that sort of very, very sort of treatment that you are describing. Because my experience is that there are too many bullies in these hospitals that control you as a patient, give you no options, make it very difficult for you to leave, to go and have a walk or see somebody or give you a degree of freedom. Your life is suddenly in the hands of other people.
Yeah, well, I think that's a hangover from the past. I don't want to be controversial here, but I think we could possibly shoot a few of the people who work in mental health, because their attitudes and their behaviours aren't consistent with a recovery perspective. At the centre of my understanding of recovery or discovery is the notion of self-determination. that the person that I'm dealing with works in partnership with me and conducts themselves in a manner that is that is human.
And conducive to your own personal responsibility and, you know, putting trust in you that you want to get better and you are taking your own initiatives to do that.
Yeah, well, I suppose the other thing too is many of them have come through a system, you know, that they've been involved in and everything. And, you know, just as self-stigma can be counterproductive to the way I view the world and everything, I think some of these practitioners, or I wouldn't call them practitioners, I'd call them minders more than anything else. I think they've come with a large amount of prejudgment, a large amount of discrimination and stuff like that. So, but I am positive that we are moving towards a more humanitarian well-being perspective. I think of my involvement with the CEP program with Mata Uraki and Te Pau and sharing my story there about realising that many of us have addiction and mental distress occurring simultaneously, and the notion that my physical well-being is intimately connected with my psychological well-being, and that there's a spiritual element to it all and everything. So I think paradigm shifts like that take a very, very long time to happen. But I'm a person that thinks globally and acts locally. So the best thing I can do is actually put that paradigm shift into my own life and share it with others I can.
And be a model and ambassador for that paradigm shift.
Yes, but also not privileging my own experience.
Right.
Sharing my experience in a way that gives people the right to actually take what they want and to ignore the rest. I think there's a real danger sometimes in thinking that I might have all the answers and stuff like that and everything. I think if I had all the answers, I wouldn't be having those 3 days, would I?
Right, so, that's exactly right.
And I find when I do share with people that I invariably come away with a little gem or something from that particular person, no matter how much difficulty they're having. One of the greatest gifts I've found recently is really that strong notion of compassion, you know, to understand that to suffer is human. You know?
Well, I think it was a book, The Easy Guide to Something, and I read this word compassion, and this was only about 5 or 6 years ago, and that introduced me to the word, and I certainly have been trying to, now I understand compassion, to practice it. So let's take another music break, Declan.
Right. Nobody's rang me yet.
Okay, we'll give them that number, 815-8100.
That's it. I'm starting to think no one likes me, no.
we like you.
Oh, that's good. No, that's good. Other you just as well, you'd be out the door. No, this song here is done by Smokey, and it's called Living Next Door to Alice, and apparently Alice lived next door to this guy, and she just got in a limo one day and basically took off, and then the Sally girl rings and says, well, I've been waiting 24 years, and tries to hone in on the action, so I don't know.
But what, a ride in the limo?
No, I wasn't talking about that. You're listening to Take.
I've missed the point altogether, you obviously.
Have, oh, you're just you see, I'm surprised. With you. Anyway, you're listening to Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting every Tuesday on 104.6 Planet FM from 12:30 to 1:30. Here is Smokey and Living Next Door to Alice.
Just waiting for a chance to tell her how I feel and maybe get
Smokey with Living Next Door to Alice. Yours taken from us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting here every single Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM. Back to you, boss.
Yeah, well, the old Blake Shelton has had to have a little bit of explanation as to what that song's all about.
Guidance.
But now I'm totally aware of exactly what was going on with Alice and Sally. But we're talking today.
Those two weren't having anything.
No. I'm quite clear on that too. Yeah. But today we're on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. We're talking to Martin about his experiences with both mental health and addictions. And it's probably no surprise that he is a consumer advisor in mental health and addiction. But Martin, what comes first? Is it a bit of a chicken and egg situation?
I think it is for me. I wouldn't be so bold as to say what it's like for everybody because I don't actually have that right. I think for me, the depression and the anxiety were ways of living with living in an environment that I considered dangerous and unpredictable and that I was likely to be abandoned at any time. I think those particular behaviours sort of proliferated my movement towards addiction and everything. I think growing up in a family where alcoholism was rife, I think I cottoned on to the fact that certain behaviours got certain results and stuff like that. I think, if anything, what really sort of brought it home to me was once I gave up the drugs and the alcohol, I no longer experienced the movement towards mania that was so prominent in particular parts of my life. And so what I realised was that these two particular components of my life were intricately bound up. And that I could do certain things about certain things, and I could get help with other things and stuff like that. So I think I was very, very fortunate in the fact that I was given a set of tools. I was given a way of looking at things and everything that took away the complexity and the bewilderment about it and all and everything, and realised very quickly that it was the actions that were going to get the results rather than the thinking, that I had certain propensities of thinking that have been with me for a very, very long period of time, and they no longer served the purpose that they were designed for. In actual fact, they stopped me having a rich, full and happy life, you know.
So you mentioned a set of tools. Did you discover that set of tools, or were you given some of those tools and you found others?
I think what I was given initially was a set of very basic tools, and as a result of looking to become weller or to live life fuller, I went looking for different tools and different things and everything. So first and foremost, when I gave up alcohol and drugs, I was consumed with depression and anxiety. So the first thing that I really needed to do was to sort of quell that anxiety and sort of get a handle on the depression. And that's where the medication became very important for me. And around that medication was a discussion with my caregivers or the people who are entrusted to my care about what would work best. They explained to me that certain of the older antidepressants did have anti-anxiety components. Some of them work better with men, with women and everything. So we tried a few and stuff like that. And finally I found one that relieved the anxiety, and so I could start to use many of the cognitive behavioural tools that I'd been introduced to. So quite simply for me, cognitive behavioural tools sort of involve things like mindfulness, about returning to a particular point in my being where everything around me is having very little impact upon me, and then going out from there. Positive self-talk was a very important one for me. I have a propensity to think a particular way, not to acknowledge my own worth. I have a propensity to think it's going to be like this all the time and everything. So I was able to rewrite scenarios in a more positive way. But the funny thing I found about that is they're no good unless you actually practice them. Actually, I should go back a little bit. I should say they are no good for me unless I practice them. So, you know, it's all very well having the tools, but it's actually knowing how to use them and using them regularly for me. And it's an ongoing thing. And very early on, I realised that I had a gap in my life, and that was the spiritual, Wairua, under Te Whare Tapawhā. And so I started to develop a consciousness of a power greater than myself, and I was able to see that in the world around me. I was able to see it in the smile of a child, in the beauty of the trees around me, in the feeling of the breeze on my face and stuff like that. So, and then I went about sort of looking at various disciplines like Buddhism and stuff like that and everything. So I suppose what it was around building up a curiosity and actually going looking for things.
Is medication still a factor in your wellness?
I'm not on any current medication and everything, but I do have times where I might feel myself drifting back towards the mania. So I have around me a very robust support network. I have a group of friends who know me well and can actually say to me if I'm you know, getting a bit wobbly or something like that. And I have a GP that I can trust, that he knows that if I need to go back on medication, he knows what my preferred medication is. He knows that if I ask for it, I need it. So yeah, while it isn't a part of my life at the moment, it remains in my toolkit.
I mean, are you under any pressure from the medical professionals to stay on the medication, or are they happy that you are aware of when things are getting a bit wobbly and you can go back on the medication?
It was very much negotiation. In the early days, they had very little confidence that I could manage my own condition. And I can understand to a certain extent their reluctance to do that, but I had some very positive health professionals working with me and everything, and we were always under the notion that the results will tell. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's very important too, just to have that strong network around you. But I noticed when I had my second high coming on, everyone said, oh, we noticed it, and I said, well, why didn't you say something? I was aware of it because of the first time, I call it my Pacific Tsunami Early Warning Detection System, which doesn't always work. But I just...
Well, your friends, you're saying that your friends saw it,
well,
but they didn't mention it.
They spotted it. Oh, we saw there was a change, and I'm thinking, well, it was lucky that I was able to catch it, and I'm lucky to have direct contact with home number and cell phone of my psychiatrist because we've developed a good friendship. But I just wanted to briefly mention what you were saying about seeing the things like the smile on a child's face, and I find for me sometimes just sitting out on the deck and just taking that time to stop and actually watch a bird bouncing along and having a feed or when they fly by, it's amazing how good it is for the soul. But I think where perhaps you and I are at is it's getting yourself back to that position where you feel you can do that self-managing. And unfortunately, I think some people with their environment they're coming out to, coming home to or whatever, perhaps isn't as conducive to what it ideally could, well, not could be, but ideally what you'd want to enable you to be able to have that positivity and move on. And the other people I really feel sorry for, that they don't have that support system, they don't have somewhere to come out to, because it's got to be impacting and making things worse.
I suppose that's a particular motivation for me being involved in the consumer advisory movement, is that I'm very aware that it's the responsibility of the system to actually assist people to to build that sort of environment and everything.
It's empowering them.
And I think if we're going to make a difference in people's lives, then we have to realise that their lives are highly complex things and impacted upon by lots of different things and everything, a warm home, a reasonable income and stuff like that and everything. So I see my involvement in the consumer advisory area as being political action, sort of trying to shape systemic processes so that more people have that opportunity to experience that.
Yeah, I think by the time you actually work on that top tier and can get that filtering down onto the coal front, and I think that's what we need at the moment because of what we're seeing with the mental health system, the suicides and that sort of thing. And you're both mentioning about the program about firefighters and what was happening to them, which I watched last night off the Sunday program.
Yeah, no, well, we have to do, we were talking about that before we came into the studio, but the Sunday program on TV1 did a special program and an analysis into the impact of the work that firefighters do in terms of their suicide rate, cancer from the toxic fumes, throat cancer, particularly other cancers. So that's a program that our listeners could probably access through TV on demand. You've got a happy place?
Yep, I've got a happy place. It's a place in my mind that I can go back to. It's a place where I had my last drink. It's a place that was the end of something and the beginning of something, and I've been very privileged to have that place. I would go so far as to say it's a gift from God. I don't want to prejudice anybody against the concept of God. I know what I mean by it, and it is very personal to me. It's a place where I can return to in my mind, and I can be grateful for the fact that life's not like it used to be. And cultivating an attitude of gratitude is very important for me. It goes along with compassion and forgiveness. If I were to talk about my most valuable tools, I would say they are around compassion, gratitude and forgiveness. And I know only a very little about that and everything, but I know what they mean in my life. Actually, when I was coming here, I paused and went to my happy place and everything because, you know, being on air can be a little bit anxiety provoking, and I felt myself getting a little bit sort of agitated and everything. And so I just quietly sat and took myself to that happy place and realised what a privilege it is to be sort of sharing my story with you listeners and my two co-hosts.
Did you do any deep breathing at that time?
I just became very, very aware of the wind on my face, and I likened it to the wind of change. And my happy place is a place of change. It's a place whereby I was under incredible distress one moment, and then the next moment everything had changed and yet nothing had changed. So change was very much in the wind with me and everything. And I just, I use a sort of it's called a progressive muscle relaxant technique, whereby I let all the tension out through my feet. So I was sitting there and everything, and I just let everything, sort of gravity, take it all down and wiggle my toes. And I actually took my Doc Martens off and took my socks off and right. Just felt the sun and the wind on my feet, you know.
Well, it's a bit like the body scan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where I listen to a CD over 30 minutes and it takes me right through my body from my feet and toes right up through my legs and abdomen and my lungs and my arms. And I do some little exercises associated with that, even though it doesn't ask me to do that. And I think that is a fabulous resource. It's one of the most important tools that I have, and I know it gives me great confidence because I can fall back on that. And the more regularly I do it, and I think, Martin, you said, you know, it's all very well to have these tools, but unless you practice them, there's probably not going to be any huge reward.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, that comes from bitter experience, doesn't it? You know, you and I have talked a little bit about the notion of self-responsibility. You know, if I know something works, then I have a responsibility to use it or unfortunately suffer the consequences. And I suppose that's where my abstinence from alcohol and drugs comes from. I understand where they take me. And so I've made a conscious decision to not have them as part of my life.
So that abstinence, you've had a major reward from that?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I've been able to address my mental distress. I've been able to get an education. I'm very, very fortunate because, you know, unfortunately many people die of addiction. The Pink song was a classic example, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. That young 14-year-old, you know, died of a cocaine overdose. Throughout the years, I have a number of friends who are no longer with us because of addiction and stuff like that and everything. And
I mean, this is a big question, but yeah. Why do you think that drugs and alcohol are so rife in a country where actually millions of people want to come here?
I think it's a general. It seems to fill a gap in some people that's spiritual. It seems to give people the ability to act extemporaneously. They can be whoever they want to be in whatever situations and everything. Not
so
everybody.
Taking them to a spiritual realm, you mean?
Or a quasi-spiritual realm, if you know what I mean. A feeling of camaraderie, stuff like that and everything. Not everybody that uses drugs and alcohol becomes addicted. There's a large proportion of the population who can use it safely and comfortably, but there's a group of us that it's like putting out fire with petrol, you know?
Yeah. So do you feel that some of us are born with a more obsessive tray, if you like?
I think it's from my so I teach in postgraduate addiction studies and everything, and I would say that genetically and environmentally those things have a greater impact upon some people. But I think more it's not actually about the actual behaviour, it's actually about the thinking that goes with the behaviour. We have a phenomenon in recovery from addiction whereby we call it the dry drunk, which is the person who gives up their substance of choice but doesn't change any of their behaviours. So in actual fact, they're even more painful than the person who's using. You know what I mean? It's sort of like that there's a need to change, but there's no change whatsoever.
So they're not taking advantage of the opportunity.
Well, maybe they haven't been presented with the opportunity. Maybe they don't see the need for the opportunity. Those people who live around addiction are adversely affected also, in the sense that they can often mitigate the behaviour of the person who's experiencing addiction. They can, you know, they can maintain it and everything. So I think we really need a different lens to look at life. I'm very positive about the notion of moving from an illness paradigm to a wellness. I'm very confident that the notion of thriving is where we should be heading. Everyone has the right to thrive in whatever way, shape or form they see able, you know.
Well, the Mental Health Foundation uses the term flourish as one of the sort of five key values to adopt to flourish. Yeah, well, Martin, it's been very stimulating, and thank you very much for your candour and your honesty around your life. And as I introduced you, I said, well, I think that you've had a life that most of us would take two lifetimes to to have those experiences. But congratulations on, you know, the progress that you've made and all those advances, and the fact that you have this wonderful awareness of the tools that keep you well.
Yeah, well, I just want to wish the listeners all the best and everything. And if you are suffering distress and everything, good luck. And I'll put you all in my prayers.
Well, thank you for that. And
I just want to sneak in here. When you mentioned before about Wind of Change, I pulled a song up if we were going to have another one called Wind of Change with a bit of instrumental. And I wondered if you want me to just pop it under while you're winding out.
Why don't we do that?
Sounds good.
As Declan is bringing that on, I just want to say that it is the Touch Tournament for Mental Health and Addictions on the 30th of October. This is the first time that it's been run under the brand of Ember. Clearly, it was a framework initiative for about 20 odd years or 25 years probably, but the Ember Touch Tournament is on Wednesday, October the 30th at Cox's Bay Reserve, West End Road. Starts about 10, be there by 9:30, and if you want any further information, give me a call on 021 976 564.
And he's going for a change.
Yeah, it's quite a, it's all about the wall coming down, I think, the Berlin Wall. Not too sure. I know, Soviet Union, I think, about Russia. That's all right. You've got a few more for a few more seconds yet, unless you want to listen to this. You can keep reading something else.
Well, I just wanted to reinforce those three wonderful values that Martin has talked about in his interview today: gratitude, compassion, and forgiveness. And I think that those three values take us a long way down the road towards either flourishing or, what was your word, thriving.
Thriving.
Thriving, yeah. Martin. Yes, yeah.
That's us for another week. Stay dry, stay warm.
Thank you for listening. And we'll be back next Tuesday after Labor Weekend.
Sounds good.